You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny. And today it's a very special episode of the Reading Envy podcast because I have two guests here. And I've brought the mint juleps, and we're going to be talking about Gone with the Wind. So today I have with us the Book Cougars, which are made up of Chris Wallach and Emily Fine. Welcome, Chris and Emily.
Well, thanks, Jenny. It's great to be here.
That was Chris's voice, and this is Emily. Thanks so much for having us on.
I'm so glad you're here. And I was telling them it's a sweltering day in the South, and I went and smelled the magnolias this morning, so I would be in the right mood.
Yeah, I wish that I could do a Southern drawl, but I would just embarrass myself.
Well, I'm not sure that Vivian Lee did it quite well either. The person we think of as Scarlet Forevermore.
Yes.
So is this your first time reading Gone with the Wind?
For me, this is Chris. I read it once about 20 years ago.
And I've never read it. And really, it's never even been on my radar. Like, I was talking to a friend yesterday and she said, "You've never seen the movie?" And I said, "No, I've never." And she said she'd watched it about 20 times and she's the same age as me.
So, I've seen the movie a bunch too.
No, never read it.
How about you, Jenny?
God's Nightgown. This was my first time too.
Oh my, could we just start with that right there? What does that mean?
I don't know.
She says it all the time.
And I think several people who've been participating looked it up, and the only references anyone can find to it are for Gone with the Wind. So
yeah. I looked it up and I asked, I have a Catholic boyfriend, and I asked him and he said, "I have no idea."
Yeah. It's interesting because in the movie they changed that to great balls of fire.
I heard that was weird.
Yeah.
It seemed like the wrong time period for that.
It did. But she says God's Nightgown quite often throughout the book.
Oh, fiddly-dee.
That is a thing that has been around because we looked that up in one of our recent episodes, fiddly-dee-dee, because Jane Austen wrote that word. And I looked it up, and that is a word from the late 1700s that was popular. So in Mitchell's time, it may have been a little archaic, but apparently it was a word that was popular for a while.
I noticed
that only Scarlett says it. Nobody else seems to. It seems to be like her little catchphrase.
Yeah, and it's almost like her way of just saying, like, oh, like I would use the term pish, like, oh, away with kind of, or away with that idea. Or it was her way of moving on to the next thing, which I thought was interesting.
And it was usually because she was grateful for the attention, but she knew that she needed to let it go.
Right.
So did you both watch the film after reading it this time or not? I was just curious.
Yeah, we did. We watched two nights together, about an hour one night, a half hour the next night, and then we both finished it separately last night just to have it fresh in our minds. And we're both always interested to see how adaptations take things and add things and what they drop and all that.
Yeah, they dropped a few kids in the movie. Typically I like to watch a movie after I've finished a book, but since this book was so long and the movie was so long, I didn't ever get ahead in the movie of where I was in the book, but it definitely then left an impression for what everyone looks like and how the characters react. And so, you know, the second half of the book, I was just picturing Vivian Lee's eyebrows the whole time I read Scarlet, you know?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I feel like the movie is more ingrained in our heads as just part of pop culture, but I had never seen it start to finish. So I think my impression of the book before I started was formed by the movie, or what I thought I knew of the movie. I had no idea. Now, we're going to spoil everything. I mean, this book's been around for almost 100 years. We're going to spoil it. But I thought the "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn" would have been something in the middle, a romance. And then, of course, everything works out in the end. I was shocked when I got to the end of the book. And then seeing it again in the movie, I was like, oh my God.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, he walks away.
Yeah,
I know. And then you're wondering, does she get him back eventually? Like, I can see why people have become obsessed with writing subsequent novels and stories about the two of them. And if she does get him back or if he just stays away forever.
Right. Yeah.
Wait. There are people that have written those?
Oh, yeah. There are a couple novels that take up the story that are, you know, they're not necessarily sanctioned by the Margaret Mitchell estate. There are novels that have been sanctioned by the Margaret Mitchell estate. There was one about Mammy that came out in 2014 called Ruth's Journey.
Hmm.
And that by Donald McCaig is the name. And I don't know if that goes beyond the Gone with the Wind storyline or not. Mm-hmm. But there have been, I guess, you know, fan fiction about what happens with them. And then there was a novel, and I'm sorry, I don't know the author, called The Wind Done Gone, which was a novel from the African-American character's perspective.
Oh, wow.
It's reading about that, though, and the thing, I mean, I haven't read the book, but the thing that kind of disappointed me is in the reviews it says it's a parody. And I was hoping that it wasn't, you know, that it was more like a not truthful, but a, you know, really just like changing the vantage point from a different perspective of what, it, you know, how the slaves might have felt during that time. But like instead,
Downton Abbey treatment or something.
Right.
Because, I mean, it would be fascinating that Gone with the Wind is so from Scarlett's perspective, and she can't see half of the things that are in front of her because she is so focused on what she needs to accomplish to survive, that I have so many questions about the other characters. Mm-hmm. Now, especially like about Melanie, and we can get into her later, but it would really be fascinating to see a treatment from the African-American characters' point of view.
Yeah.
So let's go back to that ending, since we might as well start from the ending. and I kind of feel like how you think about the whole novel affects what you think at the end. Like, do you think she's going to get him back?
I don't know. You know, it's so hard to tell with Bonnie dying. Yeah. I think if Bonnie hadn't died, they'd probably stay together.
Yeah, agreed.
Even with the whole Ashley thing at the end.
Yeah. I mean, statistically, you know, statistics in this day and age, parents who lose a child, the marriage typically doesn't last, you know? So I do think there was heartbreak. I mean, for those who haven't read the book, you know, Scarlett's on the hunt for a man all the time. And there's a thread through the entire book that she's in love with this gentleman named Ashley. And she's just in love with him really until like the last, bit of the book when she realizes, which is very typical, I think, of especially, you know, the book starts, she's 16 years old.
Right.
And, you know, that love that you have for somebody at that age is so all consuming and you don't really understand what it is. And she was thrust into this life that she never expected to live,
right,
with a war, et cetera, and ended up out of circumstance, you know, needing to marry and partner because women couldn't just survive on their own.
I don't really see her as on the hunt for a man. I see her as being obsessed with Ashley, not really knowing who he is or what he's about. But I think it's just that young love, like the opposites of track thing. And then she does the marriages that she has are all for furthering her gains.
Right.
You know, her second marriage with Frank for sure. But her first marriage with Charles was just kind of despite Ashley and Melanie getting married.
Well, when total revenge marriage.
Yeah.
Right. And when you can't have what you want, it really colors your pursuits.
Yeah.
So, I agree.
Do you think she even wants him to begin with? I couldn't actually figure it out.
I think it was sexual in nature for him and for her. Hmm. I think they were attracted to each other sexually. And that wasn't something that could necessarily be in the book. But she always talks about, you know, his golden hair and the way he looked on a horse and the way he looked. And I think because she didn't understand him and his family, I think that was the attraction that he was so reticent and so internal that she wanted that.
And he was really the only golden boy in the whole story. Mm-hmm. You know, none of the other men shone in that way. I mean, Rhett was the bad boy, you know, Frank was old. Charles was just available.
Yeah.
You know? He was weak.
He was like a puppy dog following her around. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It's funny that you're saying it's sexual because I kind of wondered, you know, Rhett tells her that she'll never get what she needs from him, and other people tell her that too. I thought maybe it was code for him being gay.
Yeah, I didn't really see that, but.
Yeah, I just thought that was the other thing that couldn't be spoken. So, yeah, it could go either way. I just didn't understand her constant obsession, especially after she clearly lost him to Melanie, you know.
But I think, like, she, so, you know, this, there's, I can't even begin to think of where to start talking about this novel. Yeah. But, you know, like, she, there's the mythology of the South that is established in this book, and the Lost Cause becomes a religion and a fetish, even, as that's the word that's used in the novel. And I think her faith was in this myth that she had of him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, just that obsessive love. And I think a lot of people have that obsessive love when they're younger. It's great to have that kind of first love. But then if you are, I think, unfortunate enough to actually attain that person, sometimes you're like, oh, that's it.
Right.
You know, because it's not what you had in your mind as this grand fantasy.
Right. We imbue, just like we imbue objects, we imbue people who are a form of an object with, you know, our emotions and our dreams and our lustful feelings.
Objects of desire.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's what Ashley was for her.
Well, and in the end, I was disappointed that he kind of gives in, you know, and he shows himself to be pretty weak as well.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't just that he wasn't meant for the war, or that he wasn't going to be the right type of person moving forward. It was that he didn't really have a strong moral core the way his wife did.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't at all. He just was going to float along as a wealthy slave owner for the rest of his life, as they say, reading books and listening to music and riding horses. That was his life. He didn't even have any dreams beyond that.
Yeah. There was one point, I think, midway through where we ran into each other. We were doing something, and she was like, "Oh my God, Ashley!"
Well, it's been fun to be. We were at Book Expo recently, so we were together for those three solid days. Mm. It was fun because we had those little mini conversations. But then when we were on the train reading, Emily, she laughs at one point, and then a few minutes later, she's like, "Oh." It's fun to watch somebody read it as well, because it is. It's funny. It's heartwarming, and it's infuriating, this novel. It really is.
Yeah. It is so epic. And there's so many, all of the tropes and the racism is horrific. And also the treatment of women. I mean, here Scarlett is, you know, holding so many people up. I mean, people badmouth her to no end, but she was holding up a lot of people, and she was just 17 years old.
Yeah. The time it really came clear is when she goes back home and her sisters are there, and they are just horrified that she wants them to do manual labor.
And
even the house servants are like, we're house servants. Right. We're not going to do that.
We're not going to pick the cotton.
Yeah.
But I think the guffaw for me on the train was, I think there was a sentence where Frank said, it was something like, Frank was surprised to realize that a woman had a brain.
Yeah, it was like the male disillusionment of realizing that. Yeah.
Yeah. And the moment he figured it out, he started trying to shut her down.
Yeah.
They're, you know, talking about the sex and gender in this novel, there's one point too where Frank is worrying about what people are thinking, and he's worried that they're going to blame him for letting Scarlett, quote, unsex herself, which I thought was fascinating, because there is just so much in this novel about what a woman should do and how a lady
should look.
And Scarlett just doesn't do any of those because she can't in order to survive.
Right.
It's interesting because it's clear that she was trained to be this fine woman, you know, that didn't have to lift a finger, because there's pressure from her mother and from Mammy near the beginning that makes that very clear. But then her mother is very interesting because she's going out at night and helping people who are sick and helping people give birth. And I'm just kind of wondering how that fit in to her expectations.
Yeah. It seems like the women are the the mules in the story in a lot of ways. Like, you know, Mr. O'Hara is out there riding his horses and getting drunk all the time. And
yeah, he was kind of a doofus.
Yeah.
Really.
And, you know, Mrs. O'Hara is the one who's keeping the books, having the conversation with the overseer, taking care of people. And I think that I don't know. I mean, it seems kind of like a 19th century understanding of what women do. I mean, look at like Little Women.
It, you know, very
they're
similar.
Yeah, they're going out there and taking care of their neighbors who are sick and taking them food as well.
Right.
And but then she comes home and her daughters surround her and they're whining about the dresses for the party.
Right. Yeah, and she's exhausted.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Scarlett couldn't see, because there's a line early on where Scarlett says, you know, her mother didn't teach her these things, or if only
yeah. taught her.
And it's just like, your mom is there doing these things, like you weren't paying attention.
Right.
Which you're, you know, you're 17, you don't pay attention.
Yeah.
A lot of us don't anyway when we're teenagers. We don't pay attention to what the adults are doing for us. And
that's because she was too busy gazing at Ashley. Adoringly. Yeah, I mean, I think that that was true a lot, though, that the women, there was a way that the women were supposed to act, you know, I'm using air quotes, and that their waists were supposed to be, you know, 18 inches. Those scenes were so hard for me to read, you know, like she's given birth and it's like, tighten my corset.
I know. You know? And she's bitching that it's 20 inches now. After I know. Having given birth. But, you know, that's the thing. And I know, you know, it's hard to read some of these things now. And you think, oh my God, you know, the gender and the way of being a woman. And I think one of the qualities of the novel is how Mitchell does create this world.
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is the world that she's in. And the struggle of, you know, the novel says that Gone with the Wind, you know, that society is gone now, and what people try to hang on to. And there's a lot about the body in this novel. And that's the one of the things Scarlett can control is her body, other than getting pregnant. And I'm fascinated by how she is repeatedly ripping on stupid people having babies and how they're rats and how they're just another mouth to feed and how they're ruining her body, you know, and it's just 1936, right?
Yeah.
This novel came out. So I found that really fascinating that so many people still love this novel and her, even with her attitude towards children, which makes me think of how we still in our society have these attitudes and we uphold motherhood and children in this way.
Well, and even Melanie in the story, she believes so strongly in being a mother that she disregards everything she's told about how it's going to kill her and gets pregnant anyway. She's just like, no, I really just want to be a mother again, you know, dangerous.
Totally.
So one of the things that connects to the body, I think, is just the war itself. So the war is brutal and Scarlett ends up just like every other woman having to work at a hospital and care for soldiers and the injuries, and what a change in a life that would be.
Yes. Yeah.
Making bandages and being around people getting their limbs cut off without any medication. Woo.
Right. Yeah, here's a little brandy.
Yeah.
There goes your knee.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I read just this one paragraph?
Mm-hmm.
So this is during the fighting in Atlanta in Scarlet. She found Carrie Ashburn on the bottom layer of wounded in an ox cart, barely alive from a bullet wound in his head, but she could not extricate him without disturbing six other wounded men. So she let him go on to the hospital. Later, she heard he had died before a doctor ever saw him and was buried somewhere. No one knew exactly. I just, you know, just some of the graphic depictions of the war and, you know, wounded being stacked on top of each other in that way. And to the point then, too, there's another scene where she's having to have a palm leaf and she's keeping the flies off the men.
Mm-hmm.
And just how much everything stinks and how all the men are moaning. And she just wishes they would all just die.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that is so not your typical 19th century angel nurse at all. But I wonder, you know, how real is that? Like, how do people feel like that in those moments? And you don't say those things because no one would say that in public because you would be ostracized to speak your mind in that way.
Well, and then later when the people are fleeing from Atlanta and they're back at Terra and they have this just constant wave of men and they're eating their food and they have so little food and they're consuming their resources and they have nothing. And I mean, at that moment too, you can tell she's just like, you know, like if we keep helping these people, we're going to die too. Just like right. them, you know, how far can radishes go?
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And she was having nightmares about being hungry and how do you feed people? I totally get that. You know, I mean, I've never lived through a war, but I've had to feed a family, you know,
yeah.
and it's constant day in and day out. And so imagine when you're feeling that way and then you have extra people coming in and you want to be compassionate and kind, which I did think was interesting that Melanie, her best friend, but the woman that she detests because she married her, the man she loved, you know, always played the foil of the, you know, kind and wonderful and sweet natured human being that really, you know, helped to soften Scarlett's very pointy places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do think it's interesting that she spoke her mind. And I feel like, you know, for Scarlett, there are a lot of people just inconvenienced her, mm-hmm. including her own children, which I felt badly for her first son, Wade.
Oh, that poor boy. Yeah. Well, and that's another thing, too, that I think this novel does is she, you know, there are scenes in here that just are completely PTSD.
I couldn't agree more.
Absolutely. You know, with Wade and what Wade sees and how he responds to things. And then even later, loud noises, you know, startle him and start, you know, he starts shaking. I just thought that was really brilliant. And another scene too, when Ashley first comes home during the war and for Christmas, I think, and they're having dinner and he just keeps talking and talking and talking. And it's like, he doesn't want anybody to ask him a question
because
he doesn't really want to talk about the reality of war. And I think that that happens a lot these days. You know, people either don't talk about it at all or they'll just keep talking and talking so nobody can get a word in edgewise to bring up the reality.
Well, and I feel like the South in general still kind of has that about this war. Since moving here, I've been really educated, I guess is just no other word for it, of how recent everything feels to the people who live here. Because I live in South Carolina. We have a store that sells Confederate flags and memorabilia just north of my house. You know, it's just it's a really unbelievable thing. I once met a man at a party. He was the husband of someone I worked with who, you know, William Wallace, he went to his grave in Scotland and laid a Confederate flag there because he believed he would understand.
Wow.
And he's telling me this story like it's the best thing he ever did. And I,
right. Like he's very proud. Yeah.
Last night I reread the chapter in Pat Conroy's My Reading Life where he talks about Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe I would just read a little bit from that because he talks about the meaning of this book in the South. To Southerners like my mother, Gone with the Wind was not just a book. It was an answer, a clenched fist raised to the North, an anthem of defiance. If you could not defeat the Yankees on the battlefield, then by God, one of your women could rise from the ashes of humiliation to write more powerfully than the enemy and all the historians and novelists who sang the praises of the Union. The novel was published in 1936, and it still stands as the last great posthumous victory of the Confederacy. It will long be a favorite book of any country that ever lost a war.
So fascinating. It's so fascinating, too, just to see the threads that still exist today, right? I mean, I feel like she really captured that in the book, and it wasn't that long ago, and the South hasn't recovered, right?
I was reading White Fragility at the same time because I was leading a discussion of that in another Goodreads group, and I was just fascinated at how the roots of so-called white fragility could be seen in this book. In, you know, within Reconstruction, you have all of these people. They've just lost a war. Their homes have been destroyed. They're being taken away if they weren't destroyed. They have taxes they can't pay. And all of a sudden, all of these people who they were just fighting against or had ownership of are taking positions of power, are moving into places of wealth, are taking away their businesses. I mean, this is what war is.
Right. Yeah. But yeah,
and people are staying, and so they're living it.
Yeah. and they don't have the vote. They've been stripped of their voting rights.
Yeah,
and
that was crazy. Terrified
that the blacks, the free blacks, are given the right to vote. And that was interesting too, in terms of what's going on with voting and gerrymandering now.
Yeah,
and how it was presented as the Northerners bribing the African Americans to vote certain ways, and, you know, to vote for us, your new friends, the Republicans. And, you know, taking train loads of free blacks to vote places and stuff. And I thought, wow, things don't change when it comes to voting.
It feels like everything now is retaliation for that.
Right. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. And well, a lot of people listen to me, but I've read some history about how Reconstruction would have been much better had Lincoln not been assassinated, that he would have punished the South in the way that it had been punished. He would have tried to create a stronger union instead of that. And people often make connections between how Germany was treated in World War I in a similar way, being punished, and then look what happened with World War II. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, with the South never having that sense of being, I don't know, being restored to the Union as a full partner in a lot of ways, early, at least in the late 19th century.
Right.
I think things changed by World War I a little bit, maybe, and bringing the country together more. Just had Lincoln lived, it could have been a very different situation.
Well, I mean, I think the other thing, if we could just talk about the racism a little bit, one of the things, Jenny, did you get a chance to watch the biography of Margaret Mitchell?
No, I couldn't get the wireless to connect enough. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I mean, it was just under an hour, and it was a really interesting look at her life and how she came to write the book and her feelings about the book and the movie.
Yeah.
And one of the things she talks about, or no, she wasn't alive, but one of the things they talked about her is that she was really surprised at the reaction that people had that the book was racist, because she felt like she wrote really strong African-American characters, that all of them had, you know, strong roles in the book. So to me, it just showed the time and place in which she was writing it and not understanding that they weren't free people to live the lives they wanted.
Right. Even though they had, quote, freedom, they weren't slaves anymore, but they were still not free in society. And yeah, this documentary, it's called Margaret Mitchell, An American Rebel. And it talks about Mitchell's life, and that when she went to Smith College for a year, her mother insisted that she go. And there was a black woman in one of her history classes, and Mitchell was outraged and requested a transfer.
Right.
She didn't think that, you know, blacks and whites should share a classroom together. But then later in her life, she received a letter from the president of Morehouse College, Benjamin Mayers, asking her to support a student scholarship. So she wrote him back and gave him the money that he asked for. And that was
$80.
It was $80 to support a student for tuition at that time. And so it started a correspondence between the two of them via courier, because these letters could not have gone through the U.S. Post without endangering both parties because of the Jim Crow law going on at the time. But she funded a lot of students.
And she ended up funding African-American students who became doctors.
Doctors, yeah.
And then she funded a hospital. I mean, she ended up becoming quite a philanthropist.
Right.
And I feel like it mirrored, she really grew in her lifetime, just like Scarlett grew throughout the story of Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, saying that, we don't know, though, was she a segregationist? Did she believe in supporting African-American people financially and with education, which by many people was still considered uncouth, I suppose. But did she still believe in segregation, that yes, black people should have their own hospitals, white people should have their, we don't know that much about her. So apparently there are a lot of biographies of her out there.
Yeah. They, I mean, in this in this documentary, there were, what, six different biographers,
yeah, I think? Six different biographers. And, of course, yeah. Pat Conroy made an appearance.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the people who commented in the Goodreads group said that, you know, it's one thing that the characters have racist views, but she was more offended by the descriptions of people as being racist, like how they're described, like animals and things like that. So I was like, yes, that is very problematic.
Yeah, it is horrible. That is shocking to me that Mitchell couldn't see that. And I don't know if she was not being completely honest with her reaction to people's reactions, if that was more something that she felt she needed to say for PR purposes. One thing that she did say, Selznick, the producer of Gone with the Wind, the movie, wanted her to help with the script, the movie script. And she said she didn't want to because she said, you know, if the movie isn't well received by the South, I don't want to be held responsible, basically, is what she said. Mm-hmm. So I think she knew that as popular as the novel was and as well loved as it was, there is a fine line between being loved and hated.
Yeah,
that was a good short documentary about her life. And her first husband was not a good fit for her. He beat her and he may have raped her. So they make parallels to the scene where Rhett sweeps her off her feet in a drunken night. And they have this fantastic night of passion, which was, you know, borderline rape.
Right.
But she seemed to like it the next morning. That's problematic.
Yeah.
But she did write the last chapter of the book first.
Oh, really? Which
I did not know
that.
She wrote the last chapter first and then went from there. She didn't know how to start it, this whole story. I guess she worked really hard on that first chapter. Right. And I mean, it is kind of cool that this novel is so much about one woman.
Yeah.
And because that doesn't usually happen with classics. And I came across one, it's another documentary of PBS talking about whether or not Gone with the Wind is literature.
Oh,
I didn't watch it. I just watched like the 3-minute preview because I didn't have a subscription to do that. But that's one of the things, like, great literature is often not about women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not one to argue about what is literature and what is not. It's a great story, and that's all that matters to me. But what's neat is that the first line of the book, Scarlett O'Hara was not beautiful, but men seldom realized it when caught by her charm, as the Tarleton twins were.
Yeah.
And everybody always talks about how beautiful Scarlett is when they talk about this book, and it's just like, but she wasn't.
Yeah.
Like, it was like her gumption and her action and her cluelessness a lot of the times about the things she was saying that were true that other people would just not say.
I imagine her having a spark in her eye, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
And no filter. I mean, I think that's part of it. Yeah. The no filter thing, you know, she would just say what she wanted to say.
Yeah.
She really liked to win. Right. So I love the scene at the beginning. I think not having read the book before, I was just really surprised by it all over the place, but especially at the beginning where I thought we were going to be heading into a novel about war. And it's just all about this girl and, you know, her romance and what she wants and where she gets all the boys at the party to agree to have barbecue with her. And so by the end of the party, it's just her surrounded by these boys. I just love it. And all the women, all the girls at the party are mad. But she wasn't happy until every single one of them, you know, wanted her.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. She wanted all the boys and then she wanted all the money.
Yeah, she wanted to have big grand things. She wanted the biggest ring from Rhett and the biggest house. And
but she was starving. I mean, she was starving and she felt responsible for the people, for her people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is pretty amazing. Because somebody like her, she could have taken off maybe, but she didn't. She stood there and she fought and she killed.
Mm-hmm. She wanted to take off, though. Remember, there was a time when she had her child and everything, and everyone at Tara was counting on her, and Ashley came home. She was like, let's run for our lives. Which, you know, is also a common theme in books.
Yeah.
Well, and Rhett kind of did the same thing, you know, to try to separate her from everyone. They went to New Orleans
together.
Yeah. Well, and it's so funny because I keep seeing this book labeled as a romance. And I feel like it's kind of like what you were saying, Chris, like, is this literature? And I think calling it a romance is one of the ways that people are saying it's not, because, you know, genre fiction can never be. I don't see this as a romance at all. I see it as historical fiction, a character study. I mean, it has some relationships in there, but it's all focusing around Scarlett.
Yeah. And I think it just speaks so much to her humanity. And we see her good sides. We see her ugly sides. I mean, we all say ugly things and we think ugly things
right.
at different times, especially during those stressful periods when your world, I mean, how many of us have had our world completely stripped away like that? And I think that's why it does appeal to people who've been in war and lived through war as a civilian or as a soldier. It was even one thing this documentary mentioned was that it was banned by the Nazis and it was also banned by the Russians.
The book
was, because it was pretty much anti-war. Scarlett is anti-war. Mm-hmm. And so is Rhett. And even so is Ashley.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, wars are, they, you know, by the time they're over, no one remembers what they were about anyway. And everybody regrets it.
Here's a good quote from the second section. This is around the time where she's being forced to care for the men in the hospital. In a sudden flash of self-knowledge that made her mouth pop open with astonishment, she realized that she did not share with these women their fierce pride, their desire to sacrifice themselves and everything they had for the cause. She knew the cause meant nothing at all to her, and that she was bored with hearing other people talk about it with that fanatic look in their eyes. The cause didn't seem sacred to her. The war didn't seem to be a holy affair, but a nuisance that killed men senselessly and cost money and made luxuries hard to get.
Yeah. And then there's Rhett, who talks about how there's more money to be made in empire, in the destruction of an empire and a society than in the maintaining of it, which really rings true to me today.
Yeah.
With a lot of the destruction of things going on in the world, there's money to be made on that. I mean,
well, and it always boils down to money. I mean, greed and power and all of that revolves around money. So Scarlett was in constant pursuit of money to save her beloved Tara and to keep her family fed.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Let's talk about Tara. Yeah. So I just was fascinated by this whole issue of the land being so important to her.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when she works the land, she is debased and she feels debased. So the land is about really having slaves to work it so you can gaze upon its beauty and ride horses around on it and have lovely picnics. But it's not about working the land, which is really different from other American literary novels that talk about working the land being this honorable thing.
Hmm.
Like, you know, look at Grapes of Wrath or, you know, O Pioneers, My Antonia by Cather.
Mm-hmm.
It's noble to work the land, but in this case, no, it's not. In the South, you had the slaves to do that kind of work for you.
Here's a question I have, though, that's related, because, you know, she marries her second husband to save Tara, but he's the beau of her sister.
Yeah.
So what I couldn't figure out, other than her just needing to win all the time, is why that couldn't have happened if he'd married her sister.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
And that is a good question.
Couldn't
maybe
she have given her that?
Well, she couldn't have. Well, for one, it could have taken longer for that marriage to happen. And she was on a time limit. She had to get that money. And maybe she didn't really trust her sister to do the right thing or Frank to do the right thing. Because maybe Frank would have just said, no, I want my wife to come and live with me in Atlanta.
Hmm. And run the shop. And keep our money here.
Yeah.
So no, that makes sense.
I think it was a control thing. I mean, I think by marrying him, because she did control Frank, you know, she kind of saw him as a goof that didn't know how to run his business. And what do you call it? Emasculated him, you know?
Totally.
Well, see, that's the thing too, because there's another line where they talk about men's fragile egos and how easy they are to manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
And Scarlett knew that.
Yeah.
That she could, she did what she needed to do to get what she needed to get.
She worked it.
Yeah.
Well, and so let's talk about Rhett then, because he's the person she couldn't do that to. And he was so perceptive about her.
Yeah.
I mean, from the beginning, but it just kept increasing in perceptiveness. I felt, I was just like, wow, this guy is pretty smart about people.
Yeah. Yeah. This one of the scenes that surprised me the most, cause I kept waiting for them to get together. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really know the story, but I knew at some point Scarlett and Rhett were supposed to get together. And then I thought, well, maybe they don't, maybe they just, you know, circle each other the entire novel. So the scene where she's looking, she needs $300 to pay the taxes on Tara. And she makes a new dress out of a curtain in her home, which for any of you who used to watch Carol Burnett, is a very classic Carol Burnett scene where she walks around with a curtain rod on her shoulders, you know, emulating a scene from Gone with the Wind. But anyway, she goes to Rhett, who's in jail at the time, right? And knows that he has a ton of money and asks basically for it. And he says no, which completely shocked me. I was not expecting that at all.
Well, he couldn't get it because, like you said, if he were to draw money, the Confederacy would be on him like a duck on a June bug, I think he said. And they would take all his money. So he couldn't touch it.
Right.
So it was like, you know, undisclosed location kind of thing.
Right. Buried in the backyard somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's when she then kind of comes across Frank and then realizes that he has money. And so she marries him. And
yeah,
you know,
she's so smart. That's one of the things I think about Scarlett is she is so intelligent about certain things. Like she doesn't have great people skills, like interaction skills, but she knows what to do to get what she needs. And I just think, for one, in the old South, in the pre-Civil War, like what a waste of an intellect to just be this. Well, she's 17 again. That's something I always have to remind myself. Yeah. She is 17. She's very young. But that if she was just going to live this kind of what I see as a frivolous life, doing nothing but going to parties, it just seems like she could have done so much more in that society. And maybe she would have, because she would have followed in her mom's footsteps probably and run the plantation like her mother did.
I mean, she ended up being a business owner.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, so she in some ways like blossomed.
Right.
Even though we think like she's morally reprehensible in a lot of ways. And in that scene, it's when she does go to Rhett, or when she's thinking about the curtains and going to Rhett. I mean, it's described as a complete moral collapse that she has.
Right.
And I think in times of war, you know, morals are a luxury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the last thing she had to sell was her body. So.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I love the part those were the scenes I loved with Mammy, because Mammy is kind of like her conscience, you know, and in the movie, it's hilarious. I mean, you can feel this when you're reading it, but in the movie, you know, Mammy just makes like a facial expression.
Yeah.
It's like, she's on the back of the carriage with Frank and Scarlett,
I know, right?
You know,
and like, she looks like, what the, that was crazy. Now that actor, she was the first African-American to get an Academy Award for her role. They talk about it in that documentary that none of the Black actors attended the opening. And even at the Academy Awards ceremony, she had to sit alone at her own table.
Right.
Because even in Hollywood, things were segregated.
Oh, jeez.
And I just think that is just so, so incredibly sad. I have a question about Melanie. Do you think she knew about Ashley and Scarlett all along?
I think I want to believe Rhett on this one, that she just couldn't fathom it so much that she, even if she saw signs, she wouldn't understand them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Because I want Rhett to be right for some reason.
Yeah. like Rhett a lot.
Well, I also think she was just indebted to Scarlett. You know, I mean, Scarlett went to great pains to save her life.
Right.
You know,
and
to save Ashley's life. And then Rhett saved Ashley's life. And so I think Melanie was just really grateful for that. You know?
Yeah.
And they lived together. I mean, I also think that there was power and still is power in combining your resource, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for them, I think it was moral support. I think Melanie was helpful to Scarlett in that way.
Well, and maybe she just had so much compassion in her that she might have seen it as like a crush. Like maybe if she saw it at all, she saw it on that level as something that Scarlett couldn't get over, but she also couldn't have. So she would just love her through it, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, or just think, like, of course she loves Ashley. Who doesn't love Ashley?
Right.
No.
He's the sign of the South.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I found that the actor's name who played Mammy, her name was Hattie McDaniel.
So what about Belle? She kind of has a different role in the movie than she does in the book. But I liked her in the book. She's this woman of the night. But really, she's running a house and employing women who don't have any way to make money, right? So you could think of her that way. And then she tries to give money to the cause and people won't take it.
Yeah, so it's laundered in right. different ways. Well, she was a prostitute, I think, when Rhett met her, right? And he set her up in business.
Yeah, he did.
So, and I wonder, I mean, is the child that Rhett has in New Orleans that's at school, that's the child she had with her?
I made that assumption.
I made that assumption,
yeah.
too.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think of it that way. I thought maybe it was the one who had been, you know, the woman that he had slept with but not married. But maybe, was that just a rumor? I don't know.
I don't know if so that was early on in the book where he's ostracized from his family.
Right.
He's and, unreceived. Yes.
I know. That was such a funny tour.
Yeah. And that made it so great. And you could really understand then when Melanie accepts Scarlett at Ashley's surprise party that she says, "Would you help me receive?"
Yeah.
And that is just such a strong statement. And you understand what it means because of what happened to Rhett earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What a move. That was incredible.
Yeah. See, then I just wonder, like, if Melanie did know about what Scarlett and Ashley.
Oh, I think she did, because there's the scene right as Melanie's dying where India says, "I have to tell her something," you know, it's like she obviously told her something else before, right?
Yeah.
She wants to make a correction. So,
I don't know. Interesting.
Well, like, I believe she'd been told, but it's a question of whether or not she believes it. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
But getting back to Belle, I mean, I feel like, you know, that's that women, that position of a woman in charge of the house of ill repute, you know, is kind of a classic position. And I thought it was interesting how Mitchell kind of made her another powerful person, but she made her a powerful person via her relationships with the other women, you know. And so, you know, I think Melanie's role with Belle was really interesting. Again, the moral fabric and the, you know, your money is good here with me because, you know, you're trying to help and it's okay.
Well, I also like the way she kind of positioned herself as Rhett's, well, friend, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously lover too. I kind of wondered if he had this person who he could go to at any moment, and he did, then what did he need Scarlett for?
Oh, he was, I think it was, again, it was that sexual attraction and that passion.
Yeah.
With another person. But it's curious because she is so much younger.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's 47 at the end of the book and she's 28, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and that's another thing too. He's so much older. So he can see her in a different way and manipulate her. I think he can.
I think he loved her.
Yeah.
I think he really loved her.
Yeah.
That's the romance part to me.
Yeah.
Is that it's all of these people. It's like multi-layered romance of all these people circling around each other and how complicated it is to find love and to be able to communicate your love for somebody.
Yeah.
You know, and attraction.
Right. And that there are things, no matter how much somebody loves you, there are things you can say that you can't take back that can kill relationship.
Right.
You know, it's that fairy tale of I'll love you forever doesn't necessarily mean I'll stay with you forever.
Right.
You know, which I think that's why I like Rhett so much, that he does walk away.
It has a lot of inner strength to be able to do that, I think.
Yeah.
But I think that's why the death of their daughter is doubly devastating, because he describes her to Scarlett as the version of her that he could love the way he wanted to love. Well, that sounds bad. Yeah. But, you know, it was like the fiery girl, and he could take care of her and he could love her and she would love him back.
Yeah. Before the girl who was the girl she was before the war ruined her, basically, right. Or ruined his image of her anyway.
Which is crazy because she couldn't have controlled the war.
Yeah.
But it's also before loving Ashley, I guess.
Maybe, right? Yeah.
There's this really devastating moment, and I think it's in the book first, but I just watched the movie, so some of it's in my head. It just happens. But they are in bed, and there's this look on her face, and he knows she's thinking about Ashley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he thought that he had finally gotten through to her, that she actually loved him, and he realizes that she's still thinking about this other guy. I was like crying for Rhett Butler.
Well, he had heart. Yeah.
I just wouldn't have expected, knowing what I knew, which was not a lot, I would never have expected to care about him, I think.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, because he's described in animalistic ways too, mm-hmm. with his bulging back muscles and the hair, his hands and his hairy chest. Like, both Melanie and Scarlett react to his physicality, mm-hmm. I guess. And he is described that way, as kind of like this unpredictable Black Panther that might, you know, jump on you at any minute type creature.
Romance novel comes in.
Yeah.
It is a body. That bare, hairy chest, rippling with muscle.
Well, it's also like, you know, the guy that's unreceived. That's the, you know, again, it's that whole bad boy, you know, thing going against, you know, what your parents want for you, et cetera.
Girls love a bad boy.
Yeah.
So one of the things I was interested too is talking about faith in this novel, because the O'Hara family, they're very Catholic, saying prayers every night. And the faith of the South then that rises up gets kind of, you know, sweeps away, I think, religion, because it's fascinating to me that it is just Catholicism. Mm-hmm. That's really the kind of the only faith that's mentioned. But then this sweeping in then of the Confederacy and the myth of the Confederacy, to the point where there's that one scene at that first ball where the women are auctioned off, almost like on a slave auction. Mm-hmm. Melanie even says, like, oh, this is like a slave auction, when they're bid to dance with the women. But there's a banner of Jefferson Davis, and I don't remember who else. And Scarlett says, oh God, they're almost like the Holy Trinity up there. Mm-hmm. And she immediately feels bad for saying that, because mm-hmm. she feels like she's being disrespectful towards her mother's religion and to God. And then there are some other scenes where she starts worrying about her soul and going to hell. And I was just wondering about that. Like, what did you all think of that? The faith issue?
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like Ashley is the one that really had figured it out, because he had talked about how the South was like the Götterdämmerung. I don't know how you pronounce German. I'm sorry. The dusk of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
Because he says, unfortunately, we Southerners did think we were gods. So they mm-hmm. do have that religion. But then the true religion of the South is kind of the South.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That the women are responsible for being evangelists for, like, they're the ones whose burning anger keeps that myth alive and grows it in ways.
Yeah.
But Jenny, I mean, living in the South, isn't it just like, it's how you identify yourself also, right?
Oh yeah. The first questions you're asked is, who's your family and where do you go to church?
Right.
Still
yeah.
True.
Still, yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I have a friend who moved down to Atlanta, and that was tricky for her. You know, not that there's anything wrong with religion, but it's just that it is kind of in front.
Yeah.
You know,
although it's not Roman Catholic anymore, it's Southern Baptist.
Right. Yeah.
Cause
yeah.
I didn't feel like it was a big part of the book. That's funny. You know?
Yeah.
Well, I just felt like Christianity was swept away, and in came the myth of the South.
He
replaced that. But again, Scarlett was not a believer. She didn't.
Right. I mean, she seemed to have concern once someone was dying, you know, of like, now I don't know that she ever said her soul, but she seemed to have concern about, you know, tidying things up with them, which is sort of a religious idea. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, and because Rhett says to her at one point when she's worried about Frank, and you know he's died, and he said, "You're not sorry. You're just like the thief who gets caught. You're regretting that you got caught, not that you did it." Mm-hmm. And to that effect, he says at one point.
Yeah.
And then I like the scene at the when Melanie is dying and the doctor says to her, "You are not going to unload your guilt." I'm totally paraphrasing, not even well. "You're not going to unload on her. She's going to die a peaceful death."
Right.
You know, and I like that because I think so often people do want to confess to somebody when they're dying and she's like, just let them die in peace.
Yeah. Well, it's either that or they say, you know, if you haven't found the Lord, you know, it's not going to go well for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I feel like there was so much death in this book. And I don't feel like there was a lot of religion around the death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is interesting. Yeah. You know,
I guess when it becomes every day, then it changes it a little
bit. So much death. Yeah. And that's one of the things I have to say about the movie, that those scenes where, like, you know, where when Melanie's going into labor and Scarlett is running around looking for the doctor, and those long pans of just all the bodies, you know, the soldiers laying, it was really touching to me. And I thought the movie was really well done. I can see why it won an Academy Award.
Do you want to know the scene that had me crying?
Sure.
So it's after the war. After the Battle of Gettysburg, and everyone in Atlanta is standing around waiting for the lists of the dead, and they start handing out the lists, and the wife of the guy who's directing the little band, I think they find out that they lost their son, and he's crying, and he turns around, and he makes the little band play "I Wish I Was in Dixie," and there's this little, like, 10-year-old boy, and he's playing the piccolo, and tears are streaming down his face, and I was like, oh my god. It's like the string quartet on the Titanic.
Exactly. Band played on.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's a story that it's such an epic because it covers such an amazing stretch of time. I mean, my only complaint, because I'm not a historian, Chris plays that role in our team. I wanted to know how old she was. And finally, towards the end, it says she's 28. I just didn't have an understanding of how many years were passing.
Right. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, there were several children and, you know, deaths and things like that. But, you know, it's such an epic novel of just what happens in the life. You know, we all lead these lives that have many chapters.
Yeah.
Just love that part.
She weaves in history really well. Mm-hmm. Like, there are a couple of references to the West at this time period, that like Confederate POWs can pledge allegiance to the Union and then be sent to fight the Indian Wars out West. And then later Quantrill's Raiders are mentioned, who came up in that Buffalo Bill book that I read and another novel that I read recently. And it's just like, oh yeah, True Grit mentioned in there. And so that is just such a different angle of the Civil War that is not something I learned in school anyway, about all these Southerners who were out West fighting the.
Well, I also had never knew about the prisoner of war camp that was down South that the Yankees had. I had no idea.
Wait, that the Yankees had one?
It wasn't actually in a POW.
Oh, yeah, camp. He was up in Illinois.
Right, I guess it Rockford, wasn't in the South, but it was run by the Yankees, right? Or am I completely misunderstanding
that? It was run by the Yankees. So he was in a POW camp in Illinois, yeah. Yeah, they had camps in a couple different places, as did the South.
Yeah.
They had a notorious one called Andersonville, where a lot of people died. Mm. And there was a pretty intense movie made out of that. So, yeah, and because you think about that, so here you have citizens starving, you know, the POWs weren't being fed if the citizens are starving.
Right. Absolutely. And then you start thinking about the scope of the novel and the war, the whole Civil War is in the middle.
Right.
Because the novel goes before and after it, which is incredible.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's a question, and we might not want to go down this tangent because I see we're getting close on time, but why did she write about the Civil War and not about World War I? Because that was her experience.
Well, there is a scene in that, or a scene mentioned in that documentary about her saying she didn't want to go to school because her mom was very much into education, as was her dad. And she just wanted to, Margaret Mitchell just wanted to read the book she wanted to read. And she didn't want to read the dusty classics and things. And so one day when she complained about having to go to school, her mother took her on a carriage ride, just the two of them. And she showed her all these old plantation buildings, mansions that were burned or abandoned. And she told her about this civilization that was swept away and, you know, what made people be able to survive when so many didn't. And so that, and I just think like she heard so many stories. She grew up hearing those stories by people mm-hmm. who fought in it and by women who survived the war. So I think it was just
kind of lore that she wanted to explore the lore of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was, wasn't it that she lived on Peachtree Street?
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
Which is like a central narrative of the entire book, really.
Yeah.
And that was actually something that surprised me. Somehow in my head, I thought Gone with the Wind was set in Savannah. So.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Surprise.
Yeah.
No, it's a cool convergence because, you know, she talks about how Scarlett was born around the time Atlanta was founded and that they were both new and upcoming and rough and tumble and then flashy and all this kind of stuff. So that was kind of a neat parallelism in the novel.
It explained a lot about how huge and confusing and chaotic Atlanta is now. It has in that.
Can we just mention too, talking about the whole, that there's more money to be made in empire dismantling, the issue of the convict labor. You guys surprised by that? I didn't remember that from reading it the first time that Charlotte uses convict labor. Like she doesn't need, like she subleases these men.
Right. So and everyone except for
her.
I'm sorry, Jenny.
I just think everyone except for the worst man in the world thinks that it's a bad idea and she doesn't listen to anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all about money for her. Mm-hmm. But you just think like, so this is human trafficking pretty much. And I just think like we have for-profit prisons now where, you know, and again, things change and then they don't.
Yeah. Well, I think there's, I was going to say something not too happy, but, you know, I mean, I always think that there are people who, out there who want to be in power and the best way to be in power is to control others. And that's a way of doing it, you know, keeping them in a position where it's impossible for them to rise above where they are, you know. And it's also about profits, right? I mean, you can keep more money in your pocket if you're more profitable. And how can you be more profitable? You don't pay people well.
Yeah.
I mean, that is her slavery model that she comes from. So.
Yeah, exactly.
It is, right?
Absolutely.
So I was thinking too, like with the movie, had the movie been done with actors of appropriate ages with appropriate accents, because they're all running around with British accents, half of them anyway,
in their 30s.
I think Clark Gable was even like 57 or something.
Really?
Yeah, when the movie was made, I think. Wow. I somewhere, but it's just, again, it's like Romeo and Juliet, you know, they were 16. I think they were 16. But we have these ideas of these classics of being older people. And I think if we can get it in our minds that these are younger people, or we could even understand Rhett in a different way, that he's this middle-aged man pursuing this 18-year-old.
Right.
Just the different perceptions we would get about the novels and characters. Well, and
how ridiculous does war seem when you realize it's a bunch of 17 and 18-year-olds?
It's still today, like, kids. You know, they want the young ones to join. Well, we got to end on a happier note than that.
Well, I'm just so glad we read it. I mean, I would have never read this book on my own. And Jenny, I have to say, such an overachiever setting up the Goodreads in the, by part, you know, but what a lifesaver. I mean, it was so helpful to know how terribly behind I was all the time.
Well, and it lets you discuss parts of it with spoilers without giving spoilers for all of it, which I like doing that because I can't face Like, this is why I'm never reading these mighty tomes, because they overwhelm me and I'm like, I'm never going to get through it. But if you can divide it into pieces.
Been great to read people's comments and interact with people and hear what everybody's thinking about these different parts. It's been really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love how I'm looking forward to the Cather too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Saphira and the Slave Girl will be coming up next.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll be discussing that at the end of June.
I'm looking forward to that one. And I think I'm going to go make a radish meal later this week.
You know, my favorite way to eat radishes?
How?
Is just to take like a baguette, really good French bread, and you smear really good European butter on it, like clou gras, salted butter, and then you slice the radishes. That is a classic French meal. Yeah. Put it on the bread and butter. So good.
You know, I've done something like that when I had a garden, only I made radish butter.
Yeah.
Just like dice them up, but wring the water out and then add them to the butter. So it's the same taste, but it's so good. You would never expect it.
I'm going to make radish butter. I love radishes.
Yeah. And I don't buy them that often, but they're delicious. I love those long ones. They're so good.
Yeah, I buy them and they go bad in my fridge all the time because I always have good intentions.
Yeah, so what are you going to make? Have you decided?
Well, I also have a thing marked in here that I've done all this reading on, the beaten biscuits.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's this thing that comes from when slaves made all the food because you have to beat the dough for like an hour because you're trying to get all the air out of it and they turn into like these kind of cracker biscuits, but they say that that's the best thing for country ham. So, you know, I have to try making it. But there's a lot of people who are food historians in the South. And so there's articles in Garden and Gun and the Atlanta newspaper, and they talk about how to do it in modern times and if it's worth it. And there's I'll link to this, but there's like a 45-minute video of these women in Kentucky making them in a traditional way. It's amazing.
You know, Jenny, we don't have Garden and Gun up here.
Wow. Yeah. We don't.
It's like a magazine like Southern Living, only it's Garden and Gun.
Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for participating in this with me and for reading along. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Same here. Absolutely. I'm so glad we all read it and that everyone seems to have enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have read it and looking forward to our next read-along together.
Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode, at readingenvy.com.